Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Boyd v. Tournier, numbers 10-2052 and 10-2068. Mr. Weber?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Charles Weber. I represent the appellant Tournier, Inc. in this case. This is a dispute between a manufacturer and two of its former distributors. It's also a case involving contractual relationships that were largely ignored during trial because the contracts, directly or indirectly, bar almost all of the damages that plaintiffs sought and recovered in this case. I'm going to focus my remarks today on three issues. First, the contractual preclusion of lost profits on the plaintiff's contract claims. Second, the jury's award of 5 years' worth of lost profits on the plaintiff's fraud claims, despite the fact that the contracts at issue were limited in term to 1 year and terminable at will, and then third, punitive damages. Tournier asks the Court to vacate all but a small portion of the judgments and to affirm the District Court's grant of judgment as a matter of law on the punitive damages issue. I'll begin with the contract damages issue. The agency agreements in this case say that neither party shall be liable to the other for any loss of profits arising out of the termination of the contracts.
So I have a question for you about that, which relates to this Texas rule under which a limitation like that on damages won't be enforced if there's a disparity of bargaining power. And my question is actually whether you think this is a question of law that should be decided by the court, or whether you think this is properly a question of fact. In other words, is there a disparity of bargaining power that should be submitted to the jury?
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, the cases that we have found, Judge Wood, are sort of two minds on that. Texas hasn't definitively answered that question. We have found cases suggesting that that inquiry is a matter of law akin to an unconscionability determination. The plaintiffs have quite properly cited cases that say it's a question of fact. I think for purposes of review, though, we can adopt the plaintiff's formulation of this, which is basically if there is no evidence of disparity beyond just the fact of the party's relationship, that it's a question of law. And I think that's the same standard that governs sort of a summary judgment, if there's no facts beyond that.
I'm not sure I'm following you, because it seems to me the magistrate judge saw this as a question for the jury's. The jury must have determined that there was this kind of disparity of bargaining power, because certainly the jury must have been aware that the clause in the contract was there saying no, I'm sure you emphasized it, no lost profits. So if the jury found that there was a disparity in bargaining power, doesn't that change the ability of this court to second-guess that?
Well, it does. And, Your Honor, I think we've conceded for purposes of review that the court should use the normal standard of, you know, assuming that the jury found the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs to support the verdict.
Was there an instruction to the jury that gave them that a path to follow?
Well, Your Honor, it gave them a path in the sense that it was a general instruction on the standard in Texas, that is disparity of bargaining power, and said that the disparity of bargaining power could exist only if there were circumstances such that the plaintiffs had no choice but to enter this contract. So we're not challenging the jury's instructions. What we are challenging, though, is the fact that on these facts, on the undisputed evidence at trial, we don't believe there's any way that the jury could have reasonably reached that determination.
Was there a line item finding in the verdict form?
There was not, Your Honor. The verdict forms in this case were fairly general. They were not just general verdicts that just had a dollar amount. They asked the jury, though, just to find in favor of the plaintiffs or Tournier on the substantive claims and then enter a dollar amount. So there was no line item that asked them about whether there was a disparity of bargaining power in the sense that Texas uses that term. And Texas uses that term in a very specific sense. It doesn't mean just disparity.
I follow your argument. And if this were a question of law, it seems to me that would be one thing. But did you argue, for example, under Rule 50, that the evidence was so wanting that that question shouldn't even go to the jury?
We did, Your Honor, both in summary judgment before trial and then also in the Rule 50 motion, at the close of the evidence and post-trial as well. So that was the substance of our argument, is that this should not have gone to the jury based on the evidence at trial.
Well, okay. this whole defense is one based on public policy, or defense against the assertion of the contract provision. The contract limitation is one based on public policy, which is ordinarily in most common law settings, a matter for the court.
It is, and I think that's why the cases are kind of two minds. It's I think part of the problem is because of the way that Texas has defined in this context what public policy means. They have said that public policy in this context means disparity of bargaining power, which in turn means that no plaintiff, that the plaintiff had no choice but to enter the contract. That starts to sound kind of facty, and I think that's why there's a mess in the cases, because public policy normally is a question of law.
Sure.
But in this case, the way that Texas has defined it, it sounds a little like a question of fact.
There's kind of a predicate fact before the public policy point is reached?
I think that's accurate, Your Honor. I think that's accurate.
Well, in that sense, the jury should be asked a specific question about the predicate fact so the court can either enter a finding of void against public policy or not based on that predicate finding.
Yeah, and we do know that didn't happen in this case. There was not a special verdict form or an interrogatory to the jury that asked that specific question.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, obviously our argument is that based on this record where the plaintiffs conceded at trial, both of the plaintiffs conceded at trial, that they had other options in entering into a distributorship contract.
Could you clarify one factual point for me? The Tournier's contract, of course, gave each of these plaintiffs in their respective territories the right to handle some of Tournier's products, but not all of Tournier's products? Product lines, yes, others, no?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So was there a clause in the contract that prohibited the plaintiffs from carrying other companies' products that competed with Tournier's products, or was it just kind of a best efforts?
Yes, the plaintiffs were in fact prohibited from carrying competing products. There was
they really had to, if they were going to carry somebody else's products, it had to be a different line.
Correct. And in fact, the plaintiffs freely conceded at trial that they did carry a lot of other lines. Yeah, both during and after their selling for Tournier, they sold non-competing lines for Tournier and actually had to drop some lines because those lines went into competition with Tournier. And that was just a factor of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
But both of the plaintiffs admitted at trial that they had the option, that they had other options. And, in fact, you know, as we've discussed, they exercised those other options. They had relationships with other manufacturers. They did not have to enter into a contract with Tournier. And, therefore, under the Texas standard, that takes it out of this public policy realm. And that provision was enforceable, we believe, as a matter of law, based on the facts at trial.
Now, did you introduce evidence for each of the plaintiffs over the years about the percentage of income they were earning from the Tournier line, you know, 50%, 60%, 20%?
We did not. The plaintiffs did, though, Your Honor.
That evidence is in the record.
That evidence is in the record, and I think what it shows, I know at least for one of the plaintiffs, I believe it was Mr. Wetherill, for example, that his percentage, the percentage of his lines that consisted of Tournier products did grow over time. But I think they started out at approximately, and I'm just going on recollection, started at approximately 20% and I think ended up at about 50. I think Mr. Boyd had some evidence in the record that Tournier may have accounted for 80% of his lines by the end. And that's what causes them to argue that, well, they were economically dependent on Tournier. That's not the test, though. That's the wrong question in Texas. I think everybody is economically dependent on their employer. I know I am. But that doesn't mean, I like to think at least, doesn't mean that I don't have other options if my employer becomes...
I certainly hope that you do. But let me ask you this...
I'd like to think so, yeah.
Let me ask you this question, though. At the end of the day, even if we were to agree with you about the breach of contract provisions, and we said, you're right, this Texas rule doesn't apply, there can be no lost profits under the breach of contract theory, would the measure of damages be any different if we didn't agree with you on the fraud theories? I mean, because the measure, as I understand it, it looks like the damages are based on the same formula for the intentional misrepresentation counts.
Yeah, it's unclear whether I think it's unclear from the verdicts whether the jury sort of, in effect, double counted. They rendered a verdict on the contract claims that was based on just the remainder of the 2007 contract year. That was the contract damages, something around $91,000 for one of the plaintiffs.
They respected the fact that it was a one-year contract in that sense.
Or the contract portion, correct. Now, the fraud damages were obviously substantially larger. Those were based on an argument going forward. I mean, it's our belief, and we can't tell necessarily from the record whether the jury's fraud damages encompassed the end of that 2007 year such that they were double counting. I just don't know that. I think the damages, though, if the court agrees on the breach of contract issue or on the contract preclusion of lost profits, I think the contract awards of $91,000 and $85,000 certainly can't stand because those were based on the rest of the contract year. And from the record, we're clearly based on lost profits, with the small exception of, I think it's $1,500 in a stock option value that we pointed out in the briefs. That
you've conceded that at least was
that's actual damages and not lost profits. So.
Right, but your argument against the lost profits award on the fraud claims is different.
It is, Your Honor, and I'll turn to that because basically what happened in this case was the jury awarded 5 years of lost future profits, despite the fact that everybody agrees that these contracts were terminable both at will and each year. That is, these contracts came up for renewal each successive year. And there are two problems with the jury's award of damages on the fraud claim. The first is, as I said, they were terminable at will after 1 year, so the plaintiffs had no reasonable expectation of working for Tournier for more than a year.
But doesn't that tie you too closely to the contract? It seems to me both Missouri and Iowa recognize that on a fraud theory, you might create expectations that go beyond the letter of the contract.
Indeed, that's right. In Iowa and Missouri, I think, kind of unlike other states, where a fraudulent misrepresentation that conflicts with the terms of a written agreement generally isn't enforceable, Iowa and Missouri have gone a different way. But here's the distinction, and I know the plaintiffs rely heavily on the Jacobs case from the Eighth Circuit. Crucial distinction, though. In that case, the representations that were made went specifically to the duration of the party's relationship. They were in direct conflict with the one-year term. In Jacobs, it was representations such as, if you stick with us as a distributor through the recession, you will remain a distributor after the recession. I think there was a comment made that this relationship will go on and on. You will be a distributor of ours for as long as you perform adequately. All of those representations go directly to the term of the party's relationship. In this case, there is no evidence that Tournier made representations of that nature. That is, said, you know, I know the contract only says a year. This is going to be a long-term relationship.
They didn't quite talk about a year, but I thought they were saying things like, you know, if you stick with us, you're going to be our guy. You know, we're going to give you more products. We're going to do this. There was no, I mean, that statement wouldn't mean very much if it only meant for 6 months when it hadn't even started yet.
But I think that it could, because given the fact that Tournier could terminate this after a year, and the plaintiffs knew that and were comfortable with it and had other manufacturers that they were representing, Tournier's statements, alleged statements about we'll fill in the product void, we'll give you Nexa when it becomes available, aren't inconsistent with this being continuing to be a one-year year-to-year renewable contract. Those just aren't inconsistent.
It's a jury question to interpret these statements that are being made. I mean, I don't disagree with you that one could understand it the way that you're talking about, but is it required?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think it is, because I just don't think that there is enough in those statements. The statements, let me put it this way, those statements as applied to the term of the contract are just far too vague to be, you know, chargeable as misrepresentation, because they don't really directly relate to the term of the contract, and frankly, I don't think indirectly. They're on two different subject matters. To say we will give you the Nexa line doesn't even imply that we're going to give it to you for any length of time. To say we will give you more products doesn't mean we're going to do that for any particular length of time when you've got a contract that says 1 year. And I think that's the crucial distinction, and I don't think the jury could reasonably find that the two very narrow misrepresentations here, and I should comment on that, most of the plaintiff's fraud claims were ushered out of the case on summary judgment because there simply wasn't evidence to support them. There were only two very narrow claims that went to the jury. And for Mr. Boyd, there were only two claims for Mr. Wetherill, one for Mr. Boyd. Mr. Wetherill had the Nexa line promise. Both of them had the alleged promise about filling your bags if you drop non-competing products. But neither of those very narrow promises had to do with the term of the contract. And that's where it is distinguished from other cases that the plaintiffs have cited, where the representations really did go to the term or gave the plaintiff some sort of assurance that the parties were going to have a long-term relationship. That just wasn't present here.
So the jury was not instructed on this continuing relationship theory of misrepresentation?
They weren't instructed on that per se, Your Honor. I think that what they were instructed, they were given just sort of general fraud instructions, and it was pretty much left to the parties to argue this. And it was a little bit disturbing because on summary judgment, Judge Reagan held that the plaintiffs were restricted to just, you know, the remaining contract year on lost profits for this very reason. Judge Reagan held on summary judgment there was no evidence that there was a long-term relationship promise.
But was he focusing on the contract theory or the fraud theory?
Well, I think he discussed that in the context of the contract theory in his order, but he was also talking in general terms in saying there was no evidence of a promise of a long-term relationship. And so I think that blends over. There's a little bit of a overlap between the contract arguments and the fraud arguments. I don't think you can read Judge Reagan's comments to say when Judge Reagan said there's no evidence of any promise of a long-term relationship. I don't think you can compartmentalize that and say, well, he meant that only with respect to the contract, but not with respect to the fraud claim, because either there was a representation about the party's relationship or not. It wasn't a relationship for purposes of contract or for purposes of tort. And so it was rather a surprise when the magistrate judge, when we got to trial, said, I'm going to allow all of this evidence of future damages past the one-year contract term because Judge Reagan had ruled on summary judgment that the plaintiffs couldn't get that. So suddenly this became not a $90,000 or $80,000 case for the two plaintiffs. Suddenly they were up talking about millions of dollars worth of future damages in lost profits when Judge Reagan had said on summary judgment, there's just no evidence of that. And the evidence at trial was no more impressive.
You're into your rebuttal time.
I think I'll sit down and save my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Corwin.
May it please the Court. My name is David Corwin, and I represent the appellees and the cross-appellants in this matter. Being aware of the Court's admonition that I don't need to go through the facts, I won't. But there is a couple of points that I think need to be borne in mind as we consider the arguments of counsel and the decision you all are going to have to make today. First of all, this is not a simple contract case. This is a relationship that was built by Mr. Boyd and Mr. Wetherill over a number of years. And because of that relationship and because of the representations that were made to them, they invested time, money, and effort into meeting and cultivating physician relationships, developing employees and salesmen, and focusing on learning the products. It is important to remember that these gentlemen had to go into the operating room.
Just to put it back on track, though, the predicate is still the contract, isn't it?
For the contract claim, it is indeed. For the fraud claim, I do not believe that the contract is the predicate.
Is to lure them into the contract.
I'm sorry, sir?
I gathered you said the fraud was they got lured into a contract.
The fraud was that they believed the representations that they would, so they continued the relationship on an annual basis
based
for successive years. Based on the contract that they entered into the contract, yes,
which is a year-to-year contract.
The contract was a year-to-year contract. And bearing straight on your point, Your Honor, both Iowa and Missouri, as the Court I think has recognized, will tell you that fraud and the damages associated with fraud are not limited to a written contract. And that's the other point.
That's what I wanted you to focus on, too. Really, you know, what evidence could the jury have relied on to, in a sense, override the one-year term of the contract?
Well, the jury did rely upon, when they were properly instructed on the fraud issue and what they had to find, was that Mr. Caro, their boss, if you will, and the regional director, and Mr. Sherburn consistently and repeatedly promised them that if they dropped non-competing lines, that is, take on something that was not required by their contract, focus on Tournier, that they would be given new products as they came out, the voids would be filled, and they would be allowed to continue to sell. And
so if they did something extra contractual, something else extra contractual would happen. Almost, is this an oral agreement or that supplements, or how do you?
I view it as a representation and a promise that they had no intent of keeping, but the promise was still there. In the context, when you have new products coming out...
Is this after the contract had already been entered into?
It was... You have to look at which year.
Was it before the contract was entered into?
It was during the period of their relationship.
After the contract had been signed?
At the first contract... No, that we're not claiming that the representations were made at the first contract. But remember, each year...
Yeah, I didn't ask that question.
I'm sorry.
I didn't ask a question. I just asked whether that promises that you're relying on were made before the contract was entered into.
Yes.
They were.
Yes, certainly before 2007.
Before the first contract
no,
was entered?
No, not before the first contract. I thought
I don't know whether I'm not making myself
clear. No, I thought I admitted that, Your Honor. I apologize. Okay. Before the very first contract, they did not make those promises. That is correct.
So I wanted to ask you about the measure of damages, because if we were to agree with your opponent that the limitation that excludes lost profits is enforceable in the contract and we're on the fraud side, I'm still troubled with this 20% per year seat of the pants estimate that seems to have lain behind this measure of damages for a lot of reasons. First of all, you know, it's like a compound interest problem. You can't keep compounding at 20% per year before you wind up with just a ridiculous number. It doesn't seem to take into account at all what the demand in the market was for these kinds of products, what other companies' percentages were in the market, and it just seemed to me entirely too vague to be a solid basis for the damages award.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, both Missouri and Iowa law allows the a business owner to estimate their lost profits. Second, lost profits in either Iowa or Missouri have to be done with reasonable certainty. It goes to the weight.
I agree with that, but I'm saying, you know, just deciding that it's 20% per year because your commissions are 20%, which is an unrelated fact.
Well, there was also I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Your Honor. There was an expert, Mr. Kalblein, who was allowed to testify, and he gave his opinion that the 20% growth was the standard and it was a reasonable growth.
Didn't he also say he thought that would be spectacular and, you know, something like 9%?
Something to that effect on cross-examination, which is why the jury was entitled to view the evidence. Mr. Boyd and Mr. Weatherill, who have... Gary Boyd had 30-plus years in the medical device. That's
he
a significant...
He wouldn't have been growing at 20% per year for 30 years because Tournier would have consumed the entire market.
Well, he was only representing Tournier for 8 years, Your Honor.
I know, but you see what I'm saying.
I do, but he was growing. For those 8 years, he was growing at greater than 20%. In 1 year, he was growing, I want to say, 50 or 60%.
But at the back end, you're not going to keep growing at 20% per year. It's like a Ponzi scheme almost. I mean, you can't. I mean, there are only so many people who need orthopedic replacements.
Sure. I would concede that over time, the market's going to get saturated without new products, without adding people, without the market will get saturated, and you're going to stabilize or your revenues.
Durable products, and there's certainly no used product market for these things, I assume. So
there is not. But 5 years was that's one of the reasons the 5 years was used as the marker. We didn't ask for 10 years worth of damages, 20 years worth of damages. We asked for 5 years, and the jury found that to be reasonable based upon the evidence.
But there's no evidence about how many of any particular product were demanded, say, in Iowa or in
Sure, there was. There was evidence with regard to the demographics, with regard to the type of products, the type of markets, the fact that that it was the baby boomers that were aging, that were going to be needing these products. There was evidence as to what these markets. That's why it was so important that these gentlemen get the new Nexa product line.
Some assumption that Tournier was going to capture all of this growth in the market, or was
20%? Yeah. There was an assumption. It was based upon the belief of the educated individuals who testified. Tournier did not put anybody on evidence on the stand to contradict that. Even their CFO, who took the stand, didn't give any testimony as to what their growth plan was, what they thought their percentages were, just that they were trying to get the company ready for an IPO. So they had the opportunity to contradict. They did not object to the competency, which I think is a significant issue. They did not object to the competency of Mr. Boyd and Mr. Weatherill to testify as to the damages.
Well, I really think because they were growing at 20% per year for a while, just does not seem to me enough of a basis to assume that that's going to happen out into infinity.
And we didn't claim out to infinity. We claimed 5 years and only 5 years. It was based upon business plans that these gentlemen had. It was based upon Tournier's sole home
business plan. Plans all the time. Sometimes they're a little too rosy.
Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're too conservative. Again, it's for the jury to weigh the evidence, and we're talking about credibility now and weight of the evidence, and the jury found as they were instructed, or they were instructed properly. And that's, you know, I want to make that point again. There were no complaints of the instructions. You talk about the contract issue with the unequal bargaining position. They were instructed on that issue, and they were told they had to find that in the instructions. With regard to the fraud, they were told they had to find that these representations were made and that they were and then they decided and found that.
I thought they were given a more general fraud instruction without identifying or tailoring, particularizing the instructions to the specific misrepresentations in this case.
I don't believe that's the case. I believe the jury instructions were themselves specific with regard to what Judge Reagan said.
About the Nexamine,
yes.
And about the
future products and the product
future
Lloyds.
Products, but there was no instruction about a long-term relationship promise.
Well, I don't
and
think
that's the other problem with the damages here is that the factual basis, the conceptualization of the fraud here, is entirely linked, as I see it, to those two misrepresentations and not to any misrepresentation about a longer-term relationship, and this is a contract terminable at will at the end of the one-year term.
I was going to say, I don't like that phrase, terminable at will. It can be non-renewed.
Non-renewed
at
will
end of
at the end of term. For no cause, for any reason, for no reason at all.
If you follow what you're supposed to do, which wasn't followed at any year in this case, but more importantly, Missouri and Iowa law, which is what we're applying here, do not require. The counsel is doing a good job reading this into these cases, Midwest Home and Jacobs. Jacobs is a Missouri case. Midwest Home is the Iowa case. Jacobs is an Eighth Circuit case applying Missouri law. Midwest Home is the Iowa Supreme Court. They are on point. I believe this court must follow those cases, and there is no requirement. There was no finding that they had promised a long-term relationship. It's for the jury to decide whether those promises, if a reasonable person could believe that the promises meant or implied a long-term relationship. I think it's a red herring. I don't think it's a requirement in Missouri or Iowa fraud law.
So your point is that the jury was not required to be instructed on this?
They were not. We weren't held to the standard of having to prove that Mr. Carroll or Mr. Sherburne said, if you do this, we're going to give you this for ad infinitum. We're going to give you Tournier for the next 10 or 20 years. You don't have to make that representation. I would suggest you're almost never going to find it if that's a requirement. What you do have to prove is under the circumstances, given the totality of the relationship, given the nature of the fraud, given the nature of the misrepresent, is it reasonable for the jury to believe, giving all reasonable emphasis to the in favor of the verdict, is it reasonable for the jury to decide that 5 years was sufficient? And I think that's what we're faced with here.
Well, that 5 years was contemplated. Let me ask you about the punitive damages, because I'm concerned about that as well. If you receive damages for the alleged fraud, it's hard for me to see beyond that why punitive damages are also called for. You're compensated for the fact that there was some promise a statement on which the person relied that was never intended to be lived up to, et cetera, about the duration of the contract. I don't see anything here other than hard business practices, basically. Tournier is trying to get its product distributed. Maybe it is making a backup plan for who's going to be the distributor if it's not your clients. The magistrate judge certainly sees it that way. He sets aside the punitive damages. Why was that wrong?
Well, magistrate judge was wrong for two reasons. First of all, the jury was properly instructed and was allowed to consider. There was no objections to instructions. There's no objection at this stage. Second, taking the entire case, as you have to do with the issue of punitive damages in the context of what they did. You have to be able to see the witnesses. And I understand the magistrate judge had a difference of opinion. We believe that was wrong because the individuals, they had a fraudulent scheme that they had planned and implemented, I'm talking about Caro and Sherburne, for at least a year, if not longer.
But you're not arguing that every fraud carries punitive damages with it, are you?
I am not, and that wouldn't be the law.
Why is there more than fraud here? I mean, why is this so nefarious as to be worthy of punitive damages?
Well, because it is so nefarious, I understand we have economic injury. It's a lot easier when you're talking about personal injury, and economic injury is much different. But if you put this in a context of a personal injury, these gentlemen, this was their livelihood, and these people did not admit it. They did not care about what was going to happen to them. They did not care about the consequences. At every step, they did everything to lead them on so that these gentlemen could not go out and establish new products. They undersold, underperformed.
I understand that. I mean, I realize they, I mean, look, the economy went bad, all sorts of things happened, and so, of course, there's an unfortunate outcome for them. I realize that. But distributors get dropped every day by manufacturers, and sometimes there's litigation about it, and sometimes it's very hard on the distributor. But we don't see that as something for which people need to be punished.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I'd like to take issue. This was not – the bad economy hadn't hit yet. All of our evidence was with regard to what the economy was doing, and Tournier was growing. Second, in the context of this case, this was not a simple distributorship case. They wanted captive distributors. They did everything they could.
There are a lot of distributors that are in exclusive arrangements. I mean,
sure.
I understand that.
The exclusive, but not limited. And that's what these gentlemen did. They put themselves in a situation.
What does that mean, exclusive but not limited?
Exclusive meant that Tournier was supposed to give them their products that they brought to market for that area. It did not mean that they had to give up non-competing lines, that they couldn't work those other lines. But when you commit all of your resources, as these gentlemen did, to these product lines, you have become, to the point, economically dependent. And when you've got fraud encouraging you to do that, and it's intentional, and that's what the jury was asked to find, and they did find it was intentional, that then it requires punishment. And that's the purpose.
You've just said that all frauds require that kind of punishment, that damages for the fraud alone are not enough.
I am not suggesting that. I understand that that would be inappropriate under the law. What I'm suggesting in this situation, the jury was considered the evidence, the totality of the evidence, and decided in this situation when there's 50 other distributors out there from Tournier that they're dealing with, and there was evidence about that, when this was a repeated misrepresentation, when the plaintiffs were vulnerable economically, and when these individuals did it with reckless disregard for their interests and rights, they were entitled to punitive damages, and this company should be punished and deterred from ever doing this again. I believe that rises to the level of punitive damages.
Do Missouri and Iowa have franchise statutes that would have covered this situation?
They do not have. Missouri has a franchise statute, Your Honor. I can't speak to Iowa now. I remember looking at it a long time ago, and it was not applicable to these cases. I can't tell you why. Well, in closing, I my time's almost up. I would ask this court to affirm the verdict of the properly instructed jury on the breach of contract, the fraud, and compensatory damages. I would ask the court to remand this case for a reinstatement of the punitive damages. If there's no further questions, I will sit down.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Weber?
Thank you, Your Honor. On the fraud damages, on the future profits, their expert witness, Mr. Kilbline, was called primarily to testify that, in his opinion, the plaintiffs' quotas were unreasonable.
And actually, that's one weak point in your case, it seems to me. If you're going to complain about estimates of 20% per year, why did you set the quotas where you did, where you thought that Mr. Wetherill was going to grow by 82% over the previous year and Mr. Boyd by 56.
Yeah, both parties kind of have that problem because that was also the basis of their contract claim that those quotas were ridiculous and that nobody ever could have reached them.
So
but
they only asked for 20% per year, and here you are saying, oh, 20% per year can't happen, even though you were asking them for 82.
Right. And, Your Honor, I think the key to that is because of the new products that were coming out and the fact that Tournier was just getting into these markets, and so it was reasonable, at least for a time, to have higher than normal quotas. But long term, and for an incumbent distributor with an incumbent product, that's not the kind of quotas that would be set.
But
and
this
that's
isn't
exactly
all that long term, as he points out. It's just 5 years. So if you, again, if you kind of play with an Excel spreadsheet or something, you know, 5 years, 82% mm-hmm. covers about the first three and a half years, and then there's just a little bit left over.
Yeah, I think that we set the quotas based on, well, I mean, without getting into the argument about how the quotas were set and whether it was fair or not, I think it was set based on the new product lines, and there were a lot of them that were coming out in 07.
That's what they were relying on too, right?
But that's not going to happen every year, and
well,
I think after a while it's going to come down.
And we can assume that the jury rejected your client's explanation based on the finding on the contract claim because that was the basis for the termination of the contract midstream, and the jury had to find or at least assume that that was pretextual.
Well, yeah, and
in order to award damages on the contract claim and find liability.
The jury had to, the jury basically found their argument on the contract claim was there's no way anybody in their right mind could have reached the
right
kind of quotas that we set, which means that there's no way they can say going forward 20% is going to be reasonable, especially.
But 20% is not 82. I mean, that's what I. The span that bothers me. You thought in 1 year they were going to get 82.
For a year. But not for 5 years, and that's kind
and
of part.
They weren't saying 82 for 5 years either. They were saying 20 per year times five. You know.
But that's not how they argued it to the jury, though, either. Their testimony wasn't, well, gee, they expected us to have 80%, so 20% is reasonable. What they did is they pointed to their expert and they said, "You see, he'll tell you." And what their expert said was, and this is from the transcript, the question was, can you state to a degree of professional certainty that medical device companies will grow at least 20% a year for the next 3 years? And the answer was no. And he said, I think all medical companies will grow less than that for the next 3 years, less than 20%. The end of his answer was, I don't think that kind of, 20% growth is totally sustainable.
Did
that's
the
page,
historical
that's page 178
evidence,
of the appendix.
As Mr. Corwin says, was the 20% per year at least an accurate historical reflection of growth for Tournier products?
No. I mean, there was really little evidence on that. Tournier's one of Tournier's officers, though, testified. Mr. Corwin asked him at the trial, "Do you expect Tournier to grow 20% for the next year?"
What have you done in the past? I mean, there was some history with these companies, and so were Mr. Boyd and Mr. Wetherill experiencing during the earlier years of this contract? Mr. Corwin says yes. The evidence shows that 20% per year was about it historically.
There is no evidence of that other than their own say-so. They just said, 20% seems about right. And they didn't give any evidence that they themselves had historically experienced 20%. They tried to say, well, it's the industry standard. And they gave no basis for that industry standard. I mean, it literally was just off the top of their heads, their own say-so. And they gave no evidence that they historically had done it. And there was no evidence in the record about Tournier's historical growth other than their officers saying, no, we're not expecting Tournier to grow 20%. It's going to be a lot less than that. That was the only evidence in the record. It would have been different if they'd had some historical evidence that showed that 20% was a reasonable average. They did none of that. The plaintiffs just said 20%, one of them because it was his commission.
I think we have the point. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
The case is taken under advisement. Thanks to both counsel.